Back at Harvard, we moved into a 3-story, 6-bedroom house, which Richard Alpert purchased one afternoon. It was in Newton Center, a few blocks from the house which served as our headquarters the preceding year. In the tradition of Brook Farm, we tried something that seemed natural to us, but turned out to be some kind of declaration of cultural deviancy. We lived as a multi-family community. Trouble immediately raised its head. Some of our suburban neighbors filed a suit with the city, claiming that we were in violation of the zoning laws that limited occupancy to single families. We were ordered to appear at a formal eviction hearing in front of the city council. "Not to worry," said Dick Alpert as he picked up the phone. Our case, as it turns out, was represented by none other than George Alpert, president of the New York, New Haven, and Hartford Railroad, flanked by several company attorneys. Dick's father presented a masterful summary, citing the Bible, the Mayflower Compact, and several amendments to the Constitution. There were headlines in the paper when our extended household was officially designated a single family. Our kitchen became a busy intersection of philosophic and scientific traffic. Alan Watts and Jano, his wife, lived in Cambridge that fall and used to come by evenings. The wizard held court, drinking heavily, spinning out tales about fabled consciousness expanders of the past. And here was the true oral tradition of spiritual education in action. Alan used to tell us stories about the great mystics of history, such as the Russian occultist Madame Blavatsky, who studied with the spiritual masters in Tibet, Annie Besant, the teacher of Hindu mysticism and the so-called secret doctrines, Krishnamurti, a handsome young Brahmin who was selected by Besant to be the next Messiah, and who, at the height of his popularity, had the common sense to renounce the dubious honor. I was fascinated by, but skeptical of, these occultists who claim magic and miracle and who love secrecy and who seem to rely on gullibility and also seemed to avoid science. Alan was most instructive in another sense. He gave us a model of the gentleman philosopher who belonged to no bureaucracy or academic institution. Alan Watts had published more influential books than any Orientalist of our time. And although he could teach rings around any tenured professor, he had avoided faculty status, remaining always a wandering, independent sage, supporting himself with the immediate fruits of his plentiful brain. Alan Watts was a full-time, all-out philosopher in his words and in his actions. Alan Watts taught us to divide mystics into two groups, the serious, lugubrious, and the witty. And ever since then, I've remained unenthusiastic about pious teachers who set up schools, hierarchies, and special rituals that mimic organized religions. The Western scientific yoga, which we would help create, would avoid secrecy, bureaucracy, masters, followers, dogma, and fixed ritual. We would use the experimental method to make accessible to anyone what had for centuries been shrouded in elitist occultism. While home life blossomed in our multi-family household, things at the office were not as cheerful. Most of our colleagues in the psychology department still couldn't take the brain change work seriously. It wasn't a question of professional credibility. Our research group, all PhDs, had mastered the Puritan tradition of American education. We had played the game of academic degrees, and we had honored the traditional subject matter. Personally, they liked us and respected us, but they could not admit that our new subject matter even existed. Moreover, the professional language used by psychologists lack concepts for the types of data our experiments were producing. Altered states of consciousness simply didn't exist as a category in the psychology of that time. It was the familiar tunnel vision that has always narrowed the academic mind. Oh yes, it probably didn't help our image that the project began adapting adepts and teachers of the more esoteric disciplines. One of our guests, Swami Vishnudananda, conducted a magnificent demonstration of Hatha Yoga and psychomotor efficiency in the seminar room at the Center for Personality Research, performing a headstand on the conference table while clad in a loincloth. That was definitely a first for Harvard University. and Gayatri Devi, the Vedanta guru, dropped by periodically to exchange darshan, sometimes bringing along a few of her wealthy Back Bay devotees who seemed as titillated by our breezy brand of experimental yoga as our conservative colleagues were aghast. Meanwhile, our researchers were doing fine. We were busy publishing articles in scientific journals, delivering papers at scientific conferences. Experimenters from around the world were coming to observe our work. Indeed, our project had become the center of consciousness alteration research in the world. There was a problem, though. The drug enthusiasm of Harvard undergraduates continued to haunt us. In this, the third year of our research, the Harvard Yard was seething with drug consciousness. And if we refused to turn students on, no big deal. They scored supplies from Boston or New York. Psychedelic drugs were, of course, legal at the time. Several enterprising chemistry students constructed home labs to make the stuff themselves. For the most part, the drug epidemic sweeping Cambridge seemed benign. Hundreds of Harvard students expanded their minds, had visions, read mystical literature, and wrote intelligent essays about their experiences. It seemed to us they were, for the most part, benefiting. Inevitably, the occasional mishaps caught the attention of the authorities. A few fellows ran to the psychiatric clinic to gasp about their trips. Their flamboyant stories about altered states usually shocked the inexperienced medics. "What? You felt your body dissolve in a pool of honey? Well, that's psychotic thinking." Some students quit school and pilgrimed eastward to study yoga on the banks of the Ganges. Not necessarily a bad development from our point of view, but understandably upsetting to parents who did not send their kids to Harvard to become Buddhas. Dozens of enthusiastic bright youths phoned home to announce that they'd found God and discovered the secret of the universe. The deans became edgy about complaints from parents. The Harvard administration was caught in a bind. They were solidly in support of our research, which was winning international attention, but they were hard-pressed to defend us against the anti-drug backlash, even though we had nothing to do with it. There were other problems. Our graduate students and young instructors were picking up an ominous signal from the more conservative faculty members that their careers could be ruined if they remained associated with our research. Since the academic profession operates on an old-boy network and reference letters, this threat was serious. Under the old-boy tenure system, graduate students who didn't fall in line, who manifested interest in non-approved frontier questions, were quickly labeled flaky. As Kuhn pointed out in The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, almost all intellectual breakthroughs have been produced by mavericks pushed out of and operating independently of established knowledge systems. The older members of our group, Alan Watts, Houston Smith, Walter Clark, Dick, and I, were disturbed by this threat to our younger friends. We called a meeting of everyone involved in the research, families included. More than 30 crowded into the big kitchen at our house. People sat on the stove, the refrigerator, the counters, the floor. Dick Alpert outlined the problem. We agreed that as much as we loved and respected Harvard University, this finishing school for Fortune 500 executives was not the place for philosophic activists bent on changing practically everything. The honorable thing to do was to dissociate from Harvard and form a new organization. Dick Alpert would stay on at Harvard. He had skillfully wangled a joint appointment in the education department, which kept the door open for a tenure post. I personally felt little emotion at leaving, beyond a nostalgic regret. Exits were becoming one of my areas of expertise. I remained on friendly terms with Professor McClellan and the faculty, and everyone seemed pleased that my departure would be courteous and dignified. We knew that our program to teach the intelligent use of psychedelic drugs was as threatening in 1963 as the notion of sex education had been a generation before. But we were convinced that society would eventually come to terms with this responsibility, just as it had, out of common sense, with sex education. it was only logical that people would ultimately demand instruction in how to use psychedelic drugs and brain change chemicals intelligently. In the next two decades, billions, hundreds of billions of dollars would be spent in futile law enforcement and anti-drug disinformation programs. We knew back then, in the early 60s, that training in responsible use is the only way to prevent abuse.